And it's NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. Thanks for tuning in. It's Friday. That means we're talking politics today, Minnesota politics. The shooting at a Florida high school last month that left 17 people dead has started a new debate across the country about guns and whether any new restrictions are needed to prevent similar mass shootings. In Minnesota, a House committee debated two bills last week but tabled them, which means they're on hold quite possibly until the session ends. One of those bills would have expanded background checks to all gun sales and transfers. The other sought to give family members a legal way to temporarily restrict a loved one's firearm access. DFL Governor Mark Dayton urged lawmakers this week to pass those bills, along with one that would raise the legal age to 21 to buy a semi-automatic military-style assault rifle, another that would clarify that bump stocks are banned in the state, and another to allow for collection of data on gun ownership for public health research. Do any of these bills have a chance to pass? Are they good ideas? Would they do anything to prevent mass shootings? Here to talk about those questions and others are two guests. Dave Pinto is a DFL state representative from St. Paul. He sponsored those bills that were tabled last week. And on the phone is Rob Doerr. He is the vice president and political director of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus, a nonprofit group that works for pro-gun legislation and tries to block anti-gun legislation. You can get a question in as well. Give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Dave Pinto, Rob Doerr, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Dave Pinto, let me start with you. Would these bills that you sponsored prevent a school shooting?
Well, no one policy change would eliminate every one of the gun deaths that our state and that our country experiences. I think it's important to note that that we have an epidemic of gun deaths at rates really higher than any other place comparable in the world. But the two bills that you mentioned, my two proposals, would certainly help to do more to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people and help to reduce shootings. You mentioned school shootings, but of course there's so many other kinds as well that we've experienced.
Rob Doerr, what's the matter with these bills? Are they unacceptable to you?
Yeah, you know, they are. I think I certainly sympathize with wanting to make sure that we're keeping people safe. I'm a father myself. I've got an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old in elementary school. So the school shootings definitely hit home with me just having kids that age. But we need to make sure that we're respecting due process and that we're approaching the solutions with efficacy in mind in actually attacking the root causes of violent crime and not going after law-abiding citizens.
Well, let me just ask you specifically about these two bills, because
sure.
The one that would basically, and you hear the call for a universal background check, basically extend the background check to private sales. How does that, why is that not due process? Because if you buy a gun from a licensed firearms deal, you have to go through a background check, right?
Yeah. To be clear, the due process concerns revolve mostly around the gun violence restraining orders.
Okay.
As far as the background checks, our reservations with that are that one is when you look at where criminals acquire their firearms, the vast majority of criminals get their firearms through straw purchases. So there is a background check being done on the initial transfer, but there's criminality going on between the transfer. You know, the person who's actually receiving the gun isn't the person who's submitting the paperwork. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it, we're creating a whole tier of burdens for people to have to go to an FFL to even do a loan. If they're going to loan somebody a firearm for a week to go hunting, they would have to go through a federally licensed dealer and then have to do another transfer to get it back. And so we're adding all of these extra hurdles, but we're not actually addressing the criminals who are actually concerned about using firearms.
Dave Pinto, what about those concerns?
Well, first, I think it's important for folks to realize that that when sales happen through dealers, there is a background check that happens on most of the sales. And this bill is simply to say that there should be such a check on every sale, on the same kind of check that already exists. And when we're thinking about what criminals would do, I think it makes sense to talk with our criminal justice professionals. The Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Minnesota County Attorneys Association, they are supportive of this. They recognize that having a criminal background check on all sales rather than most sales will, in fact, help to keep more weapons out of the hands of dangerous people. There may be some, of course, that go around, but it'll certainly do things to help. And I think when it comes to considering our criminals, let's talk to our criminal justice professionals.
Well, what about this issue of straw purchases, though? Is there anything there that you could look at?
Well, I think there is a law against straw purchases. Criminal justice folks that I speak with, law enforcement leaders and officers, certainly take that very seriously and pursue it. But in the meantime, if you're a violent felon, I should have noted I serve as a prosecutor outside the legislature, and I prosecute violent felons who are found in possession of weapons, among other crimes. If you're a violent felon, you want to buy a gun, you can go to a dealer and have a background check. It's true you could have a straw purchaser. That person would be then themselves committing a crime. Or you can simply just buy from a private seller in the open market. And there's no background check to prevent that violent felon from having a gun. I think that's wrong. And as I say, other law enforcement leaders do as well. That's not the way to keep our community safe and secure.
Rob Doerr, are you going against what law enforcement is saying here by opposing the universal background check?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to note that while the professional associations, some of them, certainly not all of them, do support this. They've also supported virtually every anti-gun measure that's come up and opposed every expansion of gun rights like the Personal Protection Act, Minnesota's carry law. And there is not universal agreement between even, those professionals. From Mankato, their police chief, their director of public safety, they call it, issued a statement with a survey from their membership, their police officers, and almost none of them supported expanding gun control. But there is one other thing that I want to point out, too, is that NPR actually did a study last year that the single most dropped under-prosecuted charge in Minnesota is felon in possession of a firearm. And when those charges are dropped and these people keep getting back out on the street, those are the ones who we're concerned about. We need to make sure, I believe that the tools are there to effectively prosecute the repeat criminals who are responsible for the majority of violent crime, but we need to make sure that we're enforcing those.
Dave Pinto.
Yeah, so and I'll just say that is not consistent with my experience as a prosecutor and with the officers that I work with. When there's a felon in possession case, it is investigated thoroughly, prosecuted hard. There's a 60-month mandatory minimum sentence that is pursued. And so certainly that's not consistent with my experience. And I guess I want to just put forth a metaphor here. You show up at the airport, there's a security line. You go through the security line to make sure that the plane is going to be safe and secure. We have most of the gun sales going through that security line, but there's a second line right next to it with an open door where there's no such screening. There's no such protection. It makes no sense to have that second door. We should have everybody go through the security line. This is being used in states all around the country. The statistics are that those states tend to have significantly lower lower deaths from a domestic violence homicide. That's the particular area that I focused in as a prosecutor. It's been found to be effective. And I think we can just sort of imagine if you're on the plane, you want to make sure everybody else on the plane went through that same security line.
Dave Pinto is here. He's a DFL state representative from St. Paul. And on the phone with us is Rob Doerr. He's vice president and political director for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. You can get your question in, too. Give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Rob Doerr, let me go back to you and ask about this other bill. I think it's sometimes called the red flag bill, where if the police or a family member could go to court to try to temporarily restrict somebody's firearms access if they think that person is a danger to themselves or to others. You mentioned that you had due process concerns with that bill. What are your concerns with that bill?
Essentially, the main concern of the red flag bill is that it's an ex parte hearing. That means that the defendant is not present to face their accuser or to offer a defense. And at that hearing, the decision is made that whether or not the person's property should be seized. And when we're talking about a fundamental constitutional right, I think it's important that we offer the full protection of the law to defendants against malicious accusations. I personally grew up in a rather rough upbringing, and I've seen instances where the court system was used to settle private fights and private concerns, and used maliciously in that fact. And even though it's illegal, and but it doesn't stop the fact that somebody's Second Amendment rights, their constitutional rights, are being violated just based on an accusation with no opportunity to present their side of the story.
Dave Pinto, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think it's important to know that just like the criminal background checks, this is a tool that's in use in states around the country. Florida actually just passed a similar law. And what this is to have family members or law enforcement who become aware of warning signs, red flags, that somebody is a significant danger, that their behavior indicates that. They can go to court. They're modeled on the same kind of restraining orders we have for domestic violence situations, harassment situations. And the vast majority of the time, there is a hearing, both parties are present, et cetera. It may be that in an emergency situation, when the danger is immediate and present, is the language, which I say as a lawyer, that's a pretty high standard. If there's an emergency, it can be that the parties can go to court, the family member, law enforcement can. But if that's the case, then within a couple of days there has to be a hearing, and certainly the person who's affected has the chance to present their side of things. Again, this is all modeled very much on these other restraining orders that we already have that work very well, with the exception in this case, the standard for those emergency orders, as Mr. Dorr referred to as the ex parte, that's very, very rare, a very high standard.
Well, Rob Dorr, I mean, weren't there all kinds of warnings about this alleged shooter down in Florida? And if a law like this had been in place there, maybe they could have stopped him.
Well, I do think it's important to realize that if somebody poses that significant of a threat, that we have the mechanisms in place right now with 72-hour holds, if they're a danger to themselves or others, to address those situations. I find it hard to believe that if we consider somebody to be such an immediate threat that we're just going to go and take their guns and assume that everything's going to be okay. There's a million other ways that somebody could harm themselves or somebody else besides just firearms. So I don't think that's really addressing the core of the issue. But to your question, when it comes to Florida, their law enforcement was most certainly notified. I've heard anywhere between 30 and 50 times that law enforcement was identified, and they've admitted that they dropped the ball, that they should have intervened. And so I don't know that that having another mechanism to trust government to step in would have necessarily prevented it if they admitted they failed in their processes that they had already.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly why Florida just enacted this law, is precisely because law enforcement was aware of it, and contrary to what was said, there are not the tools. A 72-hour hold is a situation, it can be a mental health situation that is really not applicable necessarily to this kind of thing. Again, when it comes to really dangerous people, I think we want to be trusting the criminal justice professionals who've endorsed this idea as well. I want to point out that President Trump, Marco Rubio, others, this is being adopted around the country and has been in existence for a number of years. In Florida, it took the shooting from a couple weeks ago. In California, when this was adopted, there was a community college shooting, was adopted soon after that. Minnesota has had our own mass shootings, and we shouldn't have to wait for one in our state to take the same kind of steps that these other states have taken.
Let's take a caller. Josh is on the line in Hopkins. Josh, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to just kind of offer some insight on what Representative Pinto said about how we don't need background checks for private sales for guns.
I think he's in favor of it, though.
You know, while that is true, I've taken part in several private sales, both as the seller and the buyer, and I use sites like ArmsList a lot. What happens with that, though, is I've never seen somebody who is willing to either buy or sell a gun that will do so without seeing a permit to purchase or carry and a photo ID of the other party. So, I mean, I think the government needs to kind of learn to trust us, because we are very law-abiding on our own. We don't need a babysitter.
Representative Pinto.
Yeah, thank you. And I should note that I think both of these bills are crafted recognizing that the first that that gun ownership is real prevalent in our state. People have used firearms for all kinds of purposes, hunting, for sport, for personal protection, and the vast majority of gun owners are of course law abiding and are responsible. And I'm really pleased to hear that that's been your experience on that site. But the fact is that that it is something, as in other areas as well, that we say, look, if we're going to have a rule that says that when there's a sale of a firearm, that there would be a criminal background check, that that should be a rule that should apply to all sales of firearms. And I think that for most folks and for most gun owners as well, they recognize that that they really want to make sure that their firearm wouldn't end up in the hands of someone who's dangerous and who's not allowed to have it.
How would that work? Would it be burdensome for people, you know, especially if you're giving a gun as a present to someone in your family or whatever?
And thanks. There are a number of exclusions. So family transfers are certainly excluded, and it's a pretty broad list of family members. There's a number of other exclusions. For those who are not excluded, the setup is to go to a federally licensed dealer. There's not a transfer of the gun to the dealer and back again, et cetera, but the transfer does have to happen at the dealer, and the dealer conducts the same sort of check as if the sale happened at the dealer. There are more federally licensed dealers in the state than there are post offices. I think average Minnesotan lives not very many miles. I think maybe 10 miles away. So in general, it really should not be burdensome at all. And it's an important check to be sure that our communities are secure. This is part of responsible gun ownership.
Rob Doerr, let's get a reaction from you.
Yeah, well, I think we do certainly have a large number of federally licensed holders, but the vast majority of them are not retail operations. They're individuals who hold a license for curios and relics or for individual collecting, things like that. So once you exclude those people, the number drops down dramatically. But it's also these licensed dealers are under no obligation to provide these services. And the ones that do can essentially charge whatever they want in order to process this transfer. We had one person testifying that, you know, they know people who a friend would want to give them a gun for self-defense, but they were in Minneapolis or St. Paul, which have zoned every gun shop out of existence within the city borders. So now they've got to leave and go into the suburbs. They have to pay money to do the transfer. They'll have to pay money again to transfer back at whatever time the firearm goes back. You're creating additional burdens, but again, it's on the people who want to be law-abiding, who would otherwise be, you know, perfectly law-abiding and pose no harm to anybody. But yeah, this equates to putting a sign next to, you know, Representative Pinto's hypothetical airport line, just saying criminals don't use this line. It's the law-abiding citizens are going to obey the sign and go through security, but the criminals are still going to just keep going through that open hole. We're not actually addressing the heart of the issue.
Dave Pinto.
Yes, and I should have noted before that in that airport security line, to continue the metaphor, where there is a background check, there are 150,000 prohibited people who are prevented from purchasing. I believe this is last year. I might have that slightly wrong. But the point is, it's a large number already who, in fact, are going through the one line and getting prevented. How many more are going through the other line where they're not? And in the states that have this, and again, many states do. This is not some new concept. In those states, there is, found that there are fewer people who are being prohibited from buying guns who are in fact buying guns. It does work.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. DFL State Senator Matt Little of Lakeville has been inviting people who oppose gun restrictions to talk to him about where they might be able to find some common ground, and he's on the line with us from the Capitol now. Senator Little, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, good morning.
Tell us more about what you've been doing and why.
Yeah, I think my approach has been this whole way is to find something that Republicans and Democrats can agree on in an effort to have a real impact on reducing gun violence in a comprehensive, kind of nonpartisan, data-driven approach. The first leg of that mission is to meet with people that you probably wouldn't usually meet with. So I threw it out there on social media and in emails that I wanted to meet with Republican gun owners, NRA members, as many people as would meet with me to talk about some policies and issues that we could work on together. So that's how this all started.
Well, what have you found? Is there a common approach?
I think there are a number of things that we actually can agree on. Now, I would say that agreement in the public doesn't always equate to agreement in St. Paul, but I think we can get there. First and foremost, everybody seems to agree with mental health funding, that in and of itself, it would be a good thing in our schools and as a whole for our public. The second issue that there seems to be broad bipartisan agreement on is some school security funds for school districts to make the best decision for their district.
Okay.
Now, there's another go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So there's another kind of more nuanced idea from Senator Latz that that I have found amongst Republican gun owners has some support, which is this idea of voluntary ineligibility to own or purchase a firearm. It would be a great tool basically for mental health practitioners to kind of counsel people that maybe they shouldn't have a gun for a year or whatever period we choose. So that they are self-removing themselves from owning a firearm. And that doesn't have any of the due process concerns that I think Mr. Doras mentioned because it's voluntary. So I think that's a good nuanced idea that seems to have broad support as well.
Are you confident that you can get a vote on these? And are you confident, well, I mean, the mental health aspect of it, the funding aspect has already been introduced. Are you confident these things will pass?
Well, we're going to keep working at it. I would never say I'm 100% confident that things will pass. You know, what I'm trying to express to people here and to the public that there are people that are working across the aisle over here to do something that matters to reduce gun violence.
All right. Well, Matt Little, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yep, no problem.
Matt Little is a DFL senator from Lakeville. And let's go back to the phones, take a call from Sarah in St. Paul.
Hi, good morning. I am a registered nurse and a Master of Public Health student. My question is directed at Mr. Doar. You said earlier in the program that we need to figure out the root cause of these shootings, and then I would like to ask your thoughts on the Dickey Amendment from 1996, which stripped pretty much all funding from the CDC for the ability to study gun violence as a public health issue, and can we then expect that you will become a proponent for helping to overturn that?
Rob Doar.
First off, we work exclusively at the state level, so we're not going to be involved at the federal level. The Dickey Amendment was a response to the CDC using their funds to push specifically for gun control agendas. And that is the limitation of the Dickey Amendment, is that they cannot use their funds to advocate for gun control. It does not prevent them from doing research. They do firearms-related death research. You can find it on their website. And there's also, you can go to grants.gov and find that there's millions of dollars available from the federal government for entities that want to do research into gun-related deaths. And so I think the Dickey Amendment gets attributed to a federal ban on study, and it most certainly isn't.
I have to ask you, Rob Doar, Governor Dayton said this week he would like to see a bill passed that would allow collection of data on gun ownership for public health research in Minnesota. Would you oppose that bill?
It depends on what the language would be. Right now, the only limitation within statute on researching data is collecting data on law-abiding gun owners. And if that's the only limitation, I guess I would have to see what information they feel like they need to gather from law-abiding gun owners that is going to help. There certainly is a wide array. The Department of Health does a lot of research into firearm-related death, and as does the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Every year they do a annual report of the permit to carry holders and all the, every single incident, every crime, whether a gun was used or not, by every one of Minnesota's permit to carry holders. So I would just have to see what data they're hoping to get, what they're hoping to research before I could voice any support.
Let's take another caller, Andrew on the line from Roseville.
Hello. Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was in regard to universal background checks. And I think I think universal background checks are a great idea in theory. My biggest issue with them is how we will be able to enforce that without a gun registry. And if a gun registry is in the mix, I think that's the biggest concern for gun owners like myself. And I can hang up and let you guys talk about it.
Okay, Dave Pinto.
Yeah, well, so to confirm, the background check itself would be the same kind of background check as happens right now. The vast majority or a large majority of the sales involve a background check. This would simply be requiring that the same check be done. And there's no additional kind of infrastructure put in place. There's a requirement that private sellers would have to go through this process. And if they don't, and if law enforcement becomes aware of information that they haven't, then a charge can be brought, as is true of any of the charges that get brought at in any case that law enforcement investigates, and a charge may be brought if it's warranted. But there is no additional infrastructure in place. And so certainly there would be, just like there are now, there would be some private sales that would be in violation of the law. And then again, if law enforcement becomes aware, that's investigated. But I want to make sure to just emphasize that there's nothing new going on here except for requiring that the sales be directed through get a background check just like all the other sales.
And Rob Dorr, your objection to this proposal is just that it puts too many burdens on law-abiding gun owners, it sounds like.
Oh, and just the efficacy that it's not going to actually address the people. So it's a combination of adding burdens to law abiding without actually addressing the issue that we're concerned about.
Let me ask you about another proposal that's come up, and I believe this also passed in Florida since the shooting. And this is to raise the age to 21 to buy an AR-15 and other semi-automatic rifles. Rob Dorr, I assume you oppose that too.
I think if as a society we want to start talking about when adulthood begins, I think we can have that conversation. Right now, we see tobacco maybe 18, maybe 21, drinking's 21, voting's 18, military service is 18. If we want to be consistent, I think we can have that conversation. I was at the press conference yesterday about the bill, and they were making it sound like these rifles, AR-15s, were some sort of an epidemic, and that they're in the hands of 18 to 21 year olds, that they're unreasonable, and that just mass mayhem would ensue. When you look at 2016 in Minnesota, there were two homicides with a rifle of any kind. It doesn't, the FBI and Bureau of Criminal Apprehension don't even segment, quote unquote, assault rifles into that mix, because the numbers are just relatively insignificant compared to other weapons used in crime.
Dave Pinto, what's your feeling on that?
Well, I certainly hear from constituents who just think that it does not make sense for folks under 21 to have access to that kind of weaponry. As you note, Florida legislature passed that as well, and certainly Governor Dayton indicated his support of it. But I hear from many constituents who have that concern.
Is there a difference? You represent St. Paul. A difference between the metro area and rural parts of the state?
I think on so many issues there are. I think it's really important. And I appreciate Senator Little's comments earlier, recognizing that different issues, and this issue in particular, do look different in different parts of the state. And on the flip side, we all want to have communities that are safe and secure. We all want to have weapons be out of the hands of dangerous people. We all want to be upholding the rights of responsible, lawful gun owners. And so I feel like there's a lot of common ground to be had here. We do not need to accept our status as a country that loses so many of its citizens to guns. We can do better than that, and we can do both those things at once. I know we can, and the time is now. We need to do it now.
Rob Dorr, is there common ground? Do you see any legislation that would prevent gun deaths that should pass this year?
Yeah, absolutely. We are always interested in addressing anything that has to do with the actors involved in violent crime rather than the tools they use. So anything that focuses on addressing the needs of people who who family members are concerned about, finding ways to equip people to intercede and find those solutions for those family members. We support keeping guns out of the hands of people who are dangerously mentally ill, out of criminals, and making sure that our justice system is acting swiftly against those criminals. And we want to be part of the conversation to find any of the solutions that we can. We are very much in favor of the measures that are strengthening school security. We've been helping members of the House and of the Senate with legislation along those lines, improving the physical security, because that extends well beyond the gun issue. But Minnesota, we're actually doing pretty good. Minnesota is one of the top 10 lowest homicide rate states in the country. We, from the 90s, from our peak of violence, if you remember when New York Times called us Murderapolis, we're down over 50% from the homicide rates and violent crime rates from those times. I think we're moving in the right direction. And I think finding the areas that we can agree on and making sure that we work on those without trying to attach the contentious issues, we can actually make some progress and then take on the contentious issues another day.
It almost sounded like you were starting to sort of make a case for some kind of a red flag law.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say, I think that there are things that we can do as a community to help family members, to help law enforcement intercede. I like what Representative Little was talking about with the self-surrender. If somebody feels like that is their only course of option, I think that's something that's worth discussing. Things like that we can, that care providers, that members of families, members of communities can do to help address the actual person. Taking a gun out of somebody's hand, removing one of the needles in the haystack, and saying, I hope you don't get poked, isn't going to actually solve the problem. We want to make sure that person is getting the help that they need, not just trying to figure out and preemptively guess which tool they're going to use to hurt themselves or others.
Dave Pinto?
Well, we all recognize that when a firearm is involved, it does take the situation to another level. I mean, we just kind of know this intuitively. So, of course, we need to be addressing concerns that what's going on with individuals, and for whatever reason they may be dangerous to themselves and to others. And we need to recognize, and we've seen this in other states and other countries, that when the firearm is involved, that's when the level of injury and death increases exponentially. And I want to point out, when we're trying to get at the understanding of this, back to the points that were made earlier about root causes and research, Minnesota does have its own research ban, essentially. And I want to make sure folks are aware that the bill that would propose to lift that, to allow the Department of Health to do some public health research, makes very clear that any data collected would be de-identified, should not at all identify an individual firearm owner. We've made great strides in our country in a number of areas. For example, deaths from car crashes, saying, okay, we're going to make a lot of changes in terms of our laws, how we design cars, a number of things. The end result of it is both that we've had far fewer fatalities from car crashes and plenty of driving. People are driving all over the place. So we can do these things at the same time. But we need to recognize that in some of these situations when firearms are involved, that's when the danger increases exponentially. And I guess the last point I'll make on this is that to remember that it's not just schools. It really is throughout our community in so many different areas.
Do you think the shooting in Florida has fundamentally shifted the debate?
It feels to me like it has. Yeah, I think that there is a sense among Minnesotans that that enough is enough. And we've had a series of these at churches, at concerts, at places of employment, at schools of all different levels, community colleges and others. Things have really changed. Yeah.
Rob Doerr, do you think the debate has shifted?
I think we every time that there is an event like this, a lot of the same arguments get brought up. I think any time that there's particularly, children involved, that definitely strikes home at the hearts of many people. I think there's a little bit more long-lasting fire in this debate, and I'm hoping that can drive to solutions that we all can agree on, and that we can use that momentum to address the things that we can agree on, even if it doesn't make everybody happy. If we can make some advancements in keeping our children safer, I think that's a good service to Minnesota and to the country overall.
Well, it starts with a good discussion, and I think we had one here today. I appreciate both of you being here. That's Rob Doerr. He's Vice President and Political Director of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus, and Dave Pinto, DFL State Representative from St. Paul. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
program is supported by the Guthrie, now playing Indecent, a play with music by Pulitzer Prize winner Paula Vogel. Inspired by a true story about theater, censorship, and love, Indecent plays through March 24th. Tickets at GuthrieTheater.org.
Programming supported by AFSCME Council 5, a union of 43,000 workers who advocate for excellence in public services, dignity in the workplace, and opportunity and prosperity for all working families. AFSCMEMN.org.
This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. Richard Painter was a chief ethics lawyer in the George W. Bush White House. Now he's a law professor at the University of Minnesota. He's also been a vocal critic of President Donald Trump on cable TV and social media. He may soon be a candidate for United States Senate from Minnesota. Painter said this week that he's formed an exploratory committee to consider a run, and Richard Painter joins me on the phone now. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
What's going through your mind here as you consider this run? What are you actually exploring?
I'm debating whether, discussing with a lot of my friends and supporters, whether I can contribute to this race ideas and a candidacy that will be successful. I would like to see a senator representing this state in Washington, two senators representing this state in the interest of Minnesotans, and I do not like what I've seen thus far, which is everyone positioning themselves for a fight between a Democratic Party, backed with money from Chuck Schumer and various operatives, and a Republican Party backed with enormous amounts of money coming in from Donald Trump's fundraising efforts, Mitch McConnell, the Koch brothers, and the rest of it. We need a senator who's going to represent the people of the state of Minnesota.
You said you haven't decided yet what party you might run in if you do indeed run, but it sounds like you're positioning yourself as maybe a member of the Independence Party.
Well, I am not a member of any party in Minnesota. I've been a Republican, so I go and vote in the Republican caucuses. That's what I did the last time around for president of the United States. And I've signed up for various Republican organizations. I don't think this is about party membership. This is about having a senator who truly represents the interests of the people of the state of Minnesota and not getting caught up in partisan politics.
Well, isn't that the way it works, though? I mean, aren't our politics partisan? And are you saying a Democrat or a Republican can't represent the interests of the people?
A Republican or Democrat could very well represent the interests of the people. And I think we've had Democratic senators and Republican senators who've done that in the past and continue to do so. I've said that Amy Klobuchar is a very strong senator. And I think Dena Smith is doing well as a senator. And I want to congratulate her for that. But it's increasingly difficult to be independent of the party leadership in this environment when the candidates are dependent upon the party operations for super PAC funding, PACs, the dark money organizations that drive these elections. It's a very, very disturbing state of affairs. And I've not foreclosed a run in the Republican primary to try to take back the Republican Party for the interests of the people. But it is an uphill battle dealing with the money-drenched politics of the major political parties.
Do you worry that if you got into the race, you might end up as just a spoiler and, you know, not be able to win yourself but hurt the chances of one of the other candidates?
Well, I'm going to enter this race if I believe there's a very good chance of my winning the race. And second, if I ended up being a spoiler, I really don't know who for, because I've been a Republican for many years, and one could say, gee, I might be a spoiler for the Republican Party. But then again, the Republican Party has changed over the years. The Republican Party used to focus on small government and efficient government and balanced budgets. And now we see a Republican Party that's obsessing on social issues and abortion and other social issues and spends money just about as recklessly as the Democrats. So I think that it might very well be that supporters of both political parties and a lot of independents would support my candidacy, because I'm going to focus on the economic issues that are of concern to ordinary people.
Would you use the campaign and the office to continue your criticism of the president?
Well, I certainly have criticized the president. I don't think he's conducting himself appropriately with his tweeting, with his verbal comments, and with a lot of his policies, such as the travel ban. And I'm going to continue to make those observations. But this is not about the president. Our system of politics has been corrupted by money in the two major political parties for years. This is a problem that was there long before Donald Trump came along, and we're not going to solve it simply by removing Donald Trump or having a blue wave or whatever the professed solutions are. We're going to solve this problem when we get big money out of politics.
Do you have a timeline for your decision?
Well, I'll be looking at this over the month of March and maybe into the month of April. I'll be thinking about this. I may decide more quickly, or I may take more time, depending on what I find out as I continue to investigate the possibilities, and whether it be in the Republican primary or an independent run.
Well, let us know when you decide.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. Great.
That's Richard Painter. He's a law professor at the University of Minnesota, maybe running for U.S. Senate. And to finish off the hour, let's check in with our two reporters at the state capitol. Brian Baxt and Tim Pugmire have been working hard tracking down the issues and the debates. Brian Baxt, House leaders released parts of a report after an investigation into sexual misconduct allegations against Republican Representative Tony Cornish. Of course, he resigned last fall. But these selected highlights they released yesterday seem to indicate there are some major problems with the process the House uses to pursue these complaints.
That's right. We may never see the full report regarding this incident, so we don't know kind of who cooperated and who didn't. But they said that there's a sense there that lawmakers aren't really disciplined for bad behavior, so that might chill people from coming forward. And they also said that it's not clear how the process is working and how it's supposed to work. You know, if someone comes forward with a complaint, are they rolled up the line to the HR, or are they kind of kept internal within the caucuses? So there are some generally impediments to people getting redress for complaints they make.
And there was already sort of a push on among some members of the legislature to set up sort of a third party office to take these complaints. Do you think that will grow now after this?
I'm sure we'll hear more about it, but I don't think that that's the route that the legislature is moving toward. I mean, they're trying to revise their policies, their internal policies, and that might be what comes out of this session.
Okay. Tim Pugmire, another big debate that's sort of dominated the week has been over the vehicle licensing system known as MNLARS. It was a big computer upgrade that has not worked as expected, and now the fight seems to be now over how quickly to spend more money to try to fix it, right?
Yeah, that's right. Minnesota IT Services wants an additional $43 million this session to fix and improve the system, but they need $10 million of that request right away, they say, to keep repairs on track. In fact, they had set a March 1st deadline. Lawmakers missed the deadline, and the agency moved ahead, sending out layoff notices to the outside contractors working on the project. There are two bills. The House is moving a bill to provide the $10 million, but it requires the Dayton administration to make an equal amount of cuts. Governor Dayton said this week that's a non-starter. The Senate has a bill that provides a lesser amount, $7.3 million, and the big question is how many of these contractors end up leaving before this funding is actually resolved.
They told us when the session started, Republican leaders and the governor, that all the hard feelings were done after the governor's vetoes last year, but when you listen to some of the rhetoric on this issue, it doesn't seem like it, does it?
No, in fact, we've heard some comments related to the MNLARS funding that suggests that some of this delay may be a payback for last year's vetoes. Dayton accused Republicans this week of not wanting to fix Minlars, trying to keep the issue alive for campaign season. GOP leaders say that's not the case, and they accuse the administration of misleading them about the Minlars problems. There was also a little dust-up on the release of the budget forecast over the accuracy of the numbers, but still the governor and legislative leaders say they get along and they can work together, but we're going to have to see how that plays out.
Brian Bax.
This legislative session has had somewhat of a surprising start. You know, we're 3 weeks into it now. The issues that have gotten a lot of attention are guns, which you talked about earlier, Minlars, and sexual harassment. If you would have said that back in, you know, the fall, that those were going to be the dominant issues of the first part of session, I don't think anyone would have believed you.
Well, Tim raised this issue about wanting to continue some of this into the campaign. Is that going to happen? I mean, when you look at Minlars, when you look at the elder abuse complaints, some of the other issues, it seems like it does help the Republicans make a case against whatever Democrat is going to run for governor.
Right? This is an election year, so everything gets viewed through that prism. And you're right. You know, the issues with the kind of bureaucracy and how well they're responding and their computer systems, you can expect to hear a lot more of that from Republicans. And from Democrats, you can expect to hear they didn't do anything or they're not doing enough on some of the things that, like on guns or school safety, if they don't get stuff done.
Mm-hmm. Big week next week, especially for Governor Dayton, right, Brian?
Yes, he'll deliver his final State of the State address on Wednesday, and then the next day he'll deliver his supplemental budget recommendations.
And that is what to do with the surplus.
The surplus that's there, and he's made a point that he doesn't want to go on a spending spree. He wants to kind of keep the appetites in check so his successor gets some money or just at least has a good base of financial stability coming in.
Last year, during the State of the State, we were all there. It turned into a terrible moment when the governor fainted. Is he taking any steps this time to prevent something like that?
He's still working on his speech, I'm told. But, you know, that speech was almost 50 minutes long by the time he got to that part. I would not be surprised if we hear a shorter Mark Dayton speech this year.
He never seems to use a teleprompter. He's always reading the speech, which is unusual for a governor.
He seems much more comfortable having the words on the page than kind of on those motioned devices.
Yeah. And always, I believe, every time he's done it in the House chamber in the evening, which is kind of
He did one at the University of Minnesota one year.
Oh, that's right.
So he hasn't taken it off-site as much as some previous governors.
Tim Pugmire, any idea what the governor will say when he issues his recommendations for that surplus money?
Well, we learned this week that school security is a priority. He wants money spent on that. He supports these fixes for the Minlars system. He'll want money for that. Beyond that, he has said very little. He specifically avoided specifics when the budget forecast came out last week and said he needed more time to look at these numbers and analyze what's available. But he said it was a limited resource that he had to work with this budget surplus. And so we'll find out. He may have an appetite for some of the tax reform, tax conformity proposals moving forward, but clearly not as much as what Republicans have their eyes on. And even Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka said last week that maybe not all the tax conformity measures that they had in mind would be doable this session.
Well, go ahead, Brian.
I just want to mention, I got my taxes done last night, and I know that there's some nervousness among tax professionals about how this is going to play out and how soon they're going to have answers about how the federal tax system is going to work and how the state tax system is going to line up with that. So I don't know if lawmakers are going to be hearing a lot more pressure, but my tax prepare certainly was on edge.
And just to be clear, it probably will take some of that surplus money to figure this out, right?
Absolutely.
Well, I can't believe you've gotten your taxes done already.
Trying to keep up.
Brian Bax, the most punctual among us, thanks for being here. Tim Pugmire, thank you for being here. We, of course, broadcast the Governor's State of the State live Wednesday night right here on NPR News, so you can listen into that. And Marianne Combs will be here on Monday with the program as well. So thanks for listening, and have a good weekend.